Do you ever think to yourself what it will be like to explain to your kids one day what life was like before the internet?
I know. For example, I use this service, Sparkplug Coffee. It delivers coffee right to my house. They use only premium Arabica beans that are direct and fairly traded. This coffee has so many roasts and flavors to choose from. It suits any taste. And I think there are generations being born now who will never know what it was like to only be able to buy your coffee at the grocery store or the coffee shop.
I know, right? Our kids may never know what stale grocery store coffee even tastes like.
That's the best part about Sparkplug. They deliver within a week of being roasted, so it's always super fresh. And they just deliver to me every month. I never even run out.
It's like your favorite cup of coffee is coming from your own kitchen, you know?
Exactly.
What was that service called again?
Sparkplugcoffee.com.
Mmm, delicious.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy birthday, Bev. Bev's birthday is today.
That's right, everybody.
She's 30 years old.
Yep. Almost as old as Justin and Salim would be. Almost, getting close.
Yes, gang, we thank you for tuning in to the Next 100 Project, the podcast that recently finished reviewing the American Film Institute's lists of 100 years, 100 movies. But that's done, and now we're doing movies we just want to cover. Heads up, because we will talk and talk and talk until we spoil something in this movie. I am Ryan Ellis, walking and talking with my own version of Celine, my true love wife, Bev.
C'est moi.
All right, the coming attractions trivia for the Before trilogy. I included all the movies, but of course we're going to cover Before Sunrise today. Anyway, it is this. Which of them has the last word between Jesse and Celine in each of the three Before movies?
In Before Sunrise, it's actually like a really cute moment where it's like, goodbye, bye, au revoir. And then Ethan Hawke finishes it with later.
Mm-hmm.
Famously, everybody thinks it's her in Before Sunset because the last thing she says is, baby, you are gonna miss that train. But the very last thing is he says, I know.
Great parting line.
Fade to black.
One of the better ones of the modern era, really.
Yeah, it's a beautiful ending. And then in Before Midnight, it switches around and it's Celine that gets the last line. He's telling her the story of how their night is going to go. Future version of Celine traveled back in time to tell them, you know, what they should do. And the last line of the movie is Celine saying, it must have been one hell of a night we're about to have.
Mm-hmm. So him twice and her once. In a movie that's all about people chatting, talking, musing, theorizing, and philosophizing.
But people who are having a conversation, they never want to end.
Mm-hmm. And it is the Next 100 Project's second movie, Before Sunrise, which was first shown at Sundance in January 1995, 21 years ago. Columbia Pictures' investment doubled its small budget in the U.S. and also did pretty well worldwide. Before Sunset doubled its small budget also in profits, and Before Midnight did just okay a couple years ago. But Bev, maybe our listeners don't know what we're talking about, so describe Before Sunrise with a skinny.
Ethan Hawke is a young American traveler who meets French lady Celine, played by Julie Delpy, on a train bound for Vienna. They click immediately, then spend the next several hours seeing the sights and talking and falling in love.
Or, in a nutshell, social media search engines could have saved these people 9 years.
That's so true. This would never, ever happen today. They would just find each other on Facebook in a minute.
Another movie that wouldn't succeed now, although it was awful anyway, is Serendipity.
Mm-hmm.
Where Kate Beckinsale leaves a name in a book and John Cusack desperately tries to find it for not 9 years, but for quite a while. That one didn't work. It was stupid. But anyway, this series is not. Here are the scores that prove it as far as critics go. Rotten Tomatoes, 100% of the critics there, 42 fresh, and 93% of audiences are in favor of Before Sunrise, Before Sunset in 2004, 95% of critics, 91% of audiences, and Before Midnight, 98% of critics, but only 82% of audiences. Nevertheless, very strong critical scores. What is Bev's critical score?
Well, I mean, I picked this movie for my birthday month selection, so obviously I love, 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 love this movie. It's so authentic and earnest and charming, and it so conveys the feeling of falling in love, all the rush and the terror, and you're doubtful, but you're eager. Jesse and Celine are so lovable, too. Not in a phony way, either. They remind me of people I've actually met, and their conversations remind me of conversations I've actually had. Richard Linklater's always been a little hit and miss for me, but this is most definitely him at his best, doing the thing that he does better than anyone else. And that's just talking about this first film. When you start talking about the series that's hopefully ongoing, then I don't think you can overstate how unique and special these films are.
He did Slacker in 1991. That was his first picture where people are walking around and talking, but that's mostly somebody theorizing, and then the story picks up with somebody else, and then somebody else, and somebody else. So it isn't just two people. And then in Waking Life, and these two characters have a cameo, mm-hmm. where they're in bed, and they're still hanging out. But that's before Sunset came out, so we didn't know where their future was going to go. We didn't even know there'd be a second movie at that point. But also in that Linklater movie, Waking Life, people are just theorizing and talking. Yeah, he does this as well as anybody. This is also a precursor to Mumblecore and other navel-gazing flicks. Kevin Smith, who saw Slacker and said, this guy made this movie on no budget. He's a nobody. I'm a nobody. I love movies. I know about that. Let me make a movie. And of course, Clerks came out of that. That also went to Sundance. Next week's movie, Reservoir Dogs, also went to Sundance. Mm-hmm. Also made by an unknown. Also a movie geek. Those three guys, as far as I understand, are friends too. Maybe because they have so much in common. Their movies aren't that similar, but they're not that dissimilar either, because they do come down to people knowing about pop culture and gabbing about all kinds of shit.
And they are similar also in the way that all three of them really work outside of Hollywood. I mean, maybe Quentin Tarantino less than the other two, but they're not really in the studio system. They're making auteur, unique, indie-type movies that are not meant for a general audience. Maybe not so much Kevin Smith, but he has a niche audience anyways, is my point.
Well, neither Linklater nor Smith really make big hits either in the sense of a Star Wars or Judd Apatow comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So the story in Before Sunrise, and there isn't really much of a story, but it's set in June 1994. They actually filmed in Vienna and other parts of Austria, based on Linklater's own similar evening with a girl named Amy in Philadelphia in 1989. I was reading, though, that she died, mm-hmm. and he never had a reconciliation with her, like these two characters have. It's not quite in real time, but it is set in less than a day. And all the Before movies, actually, they're less than one day. All those long takes, that's one of the things I looked for even more so in this film. The number of times the camera just stays with them forever. Before Midnight does too, I can think of, especially where they're driving the car for, seems like forever. And then when they're walking to the hotel they're going to go to that night. No cuts, that's a lot on the actors to have to memorize that dialogue, hit their marks. And apparently there isn't very much improvising in these films.
Yeah.
The two actors have helped shape the screenplays, and they actually co-wrote the second and third ones and got Oscar nominations both times, for that matter. But there's not much of the whole, let's just go off on a tangent here. They are saying what they helped write.
Yeah, the naturalism is surprising on that account, because it must come out in the script. He must really write the way people really speak, because it feels so much like a real conversation. It has the ups and downs and the lulls, and they have these really smart things to say, but then they also have these great breaths and pauses where they're trying to think of where to go from there.
It might be similar to the Annie Hall thing, where if you had subtitles of what they're really thinking, Woody's thinking, oh, I hope I don't sound like an idiot here. And she is sure she sounds like she doesn't know what she's talking about.
Well, I don't think you need subtitles, because that actually comes through so nicely in their performance. Ethan Hawke, he's amazing in this movie. Every time she's not looking at him, you can see that vulnerability in his face. You can see how unsure he is of whether or not he's winning over this girl, how crazy he is about her right from the beginning. There's the beautiful scene, which a lot of people talk about is probably the best scene in the movie. And the thing that really sets it apart as a great romance, and it's when they're in the record stores probably about halfway through the movie, and they decide they want to listen to a record in the listening booth, and it's just quiet. They're listening to music. They're not talking at all. And they're trying desperately to stare at each other without getting caught staring at each other. And they're just so shy and sweet, and it's so real. Like, it really is that anxiety and that excitement that you feel when you're falling in love with somebody.
Do we have a moment like that at any point?
I just stared directly at you until you got uncomfortable.
The first date.
Yeah.
Well, I remember our first date was only about 3 hours. We didn't push it too far, and that's probably smart, because you don't want to wear out your welcome, even with somebody that you know likes you, or at least you think does, and you certainly like them back. I do remember kissing you goodnight that night.
Yes.
But I did not want to push it any further than that, even if you had wanted to, because I thought, I like talking to her at the very least. If I find out in a week that she doesn't want to actually be with me romantically, maybe we really should do the thing people always say and be friends. These two probably had some of the same instincts, although they couldn't do that because they live on different continents.
But of course, us meeting and our romance happened when we were already well into our 30s, and this movie is so much about the experience of being a young 20-something. And Linklater really gets it. He reminds me so keenly of what it felt like to be in your early 20s, where you're finally free for the first time in your life, and you can make those decisions that have real consequences, and it also feels like you have these millions of possibilities. You don't know yet if your life might have you moving to a different country, a different continent. You still think, I might move to Europe. Hell, I might take up the drums and join a band. I don't know what's going to happen in my life because I don't even know myself and know what I want yet. And the movie really takes me back to that time. Like, I kind of forgot about how exciting that time was in my life.
One of them says to the other, have you ever been in love? And that's the thrust of the whole series.
Yeah.
Because later on, he marries a woman, he doesn't love her, and she's with different men. She doesn't really love them either. This is a movie that's clearly about true love, and it takes them a long time to actually make it work out. Ethan Hawke said the first movie is about what could be, the second movie is about what might have been, and the third movie is about what is.
Oh, that's a great way to put it. And after we watched this, I went back and watched Before Sunset again. I saw Before Midnight so many times last year that I didn't really feel like it was necessary to watch it yet again because I was in love with it. But, you know, they start the movie by saying, we have to have this experience so that we don't spend the rest of our lives wondering what would have happened with that boy I met on the train.
The Citizen Kane line comes to mind, where Everett Sloan's character says to the interviewer about how this girl in the parasol captivated him. Mm. I never stopped thinking about her and never even knew her name. He never met her. He just saw her, wished he'd said hello, and never did.
And so that's how he lures Selena off the train. But then the irony is that 9 years later, when they revisit it with Before Sunset, they have to confess to each other that that wonderful night they shared, that incredible magnetism and chemistry, kind of ruined them for everybody else. They never stopped thinking about each other. They never stopped wondering about this possibility. And Selena tells the story in Before Sunrise, how her grandmother tells the story about how she married her grandfather and stayed with him her whole life, but the whole time she was in love with somebody else, and she felt that it was this big waste. And that's a theme. Again, they're 23. They have their whole lives ahead of them. But choosing your fate and whether you can choose your fate and how there's all these different possibilities, different directions your life can go, it's definitely a lot of what they talk about is a big theme in this film. How did Ethan Hawke word it?
The first movie is about what could be. The second movie is about what might have been. The third movie is about what is. Because they do fight in that movie more than they're talking in the great way they are in the other two films. Or the whimsical.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first one's so whimsical because they're 23 and falling in love. They're in a foreign city. Everything about it is going to create that feeling. The second one, it's much more rooted in the real world. They are more world-weary, and they're also much more suspicious of one another and guarded.
And why didn't she show up? Because he did.
Yes, did he ever. And then he admits he put posters up.
Well, he doesn't admit it at first, I believe.
No, he eventually
takes later on, and maybe that's when she's convinced, I've got to make this work, if he wants to make this work, although he's the one who's married with a kid back in America.
And the consequences of his actions. The first movie's about this option coming into their life of being with each other. In the second movie, they have to finally make the decision of whether they want to do that or not. And then the third movie is the consequence of the decision of being together. And the third movie doesn't start with them together. The third movie starts with him with his son saying goodbye to him, putting on a plane so that he's not going to see him again for months, and he hates that. That was the consequence of his decision, and it's a tough one. That's a lot to ask of anybody.
And a lot to ask her to move over to America, a place she's never lived. And their kids, too. The girls don't know anything about America, so he clearly wants them to move there, but then it becomes about cheating, and it becomes, well, who did you fuck? Whose dick did you suck? We don't know what kind of future we have, of course. How can we possibly know what kind of fights we might have after only a couple of years of marriage? They've been together for many years by that point. Not actually married, I don't think, though, right?
No, never married.
Right. So what I'm saying is we can relate to these characters, except we don't have the terrifying highs, the dizzying lows. It's more about the creamy middles, to quote The Simpsons.
Well, they are flawed characters, and this is another kind of Richard Linklaterism that is good and that he does well. He presents his characters, warts and all, and you see it all right away in the Before Sunrise. They're young, they're kind of dumb, they're a little full of shit, and sometimes they know it and sometimes they don't, and he
Ethan
presents
Hawke
that as is.
Almost always plays characters like this, too, where he's a little, as Woody Allen would say, didactic.
Yeah, but that makes them more real, and it makes them more lovable and certainly relatable. I don't think either you or I are
lovable.
I don't think either.
We're not lovable.
Ethan Hawke, you learn by the third movie, he makes some decisions that are selfish. And Celine clearly has a cruelty streak.
Oh, yeah. She's way meaner than he is.
Oh, my God.
In the third movie, yeah.
And in a way, it's like Linklater is showing the cruelest side of a person, the way that people truly can be, and that it feels like this painfully authentic fight between a couple who love each other but are not necessarily sure that they're getting the best life they could have. Maybe they're not sure, especially she's not sure that she made the right decision.
Especially if he's going to be unfaithful. But then it's implied, she doesn't admit it like he eventually does, she was also unfaithful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's get back to this movie again, although we'll obviously dip and dive into the other two movies plenty. The reason why Jesse's even over there is that he's after his girlfriend who's gone over there for school, was it?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Her name was Lisa, and when he admits that that's why he's there, he wasn't so much dumped as he realizes she doesn't want to be with him, so they seem to mutually agree, although maybe he's lying to her.
I think he was dumped.
Maybe he was actually dumped.
Yeah.
But then in their scene where they talk on the fake phones, another great scene, his phone friend is Frank, but he does have the line, I'd forgotten it was from this movie though, that as much as you dwell on the person who's dumped you, the one who's dumped you doesn't even think about you at all.
Oh, how true is that? It's so painfully humiliating.
But you can't get over that person, and that's the problem too, is that you'd like to just say to hell with you, but when he's traveling through Europe and does just happen to meet this girl, he's obviously still messed up. Maybe it's the wrong time to have met Celine anyway, but then when you get a one-night stand out of it, that can be fun, that can also be a little bit painful. Maybe they shouldn't have sex, considering all that, although who can really blame them when you have this kind of chemistry, this kind of fun. It's a natural way to end the night.
And because they agree at the beginning of the night, they're only going to see each other this one night, so they will only ever have this one chance. It's not a promise of future, although they both desperately want to make that promise of a future together, but they're too shy. Oh, I just love that touch, that push and pull. He really pulls it off.
Yeah. Well, we just said sex. They kiss at sunset on that Ferris wheel, beautifully shot scene, and they fuck at near daybreak. The ends of the three before movies are always about fucking. The climax is a climax.
Oh, yeah, the very last thing they're talking about in Before Midnight is when she says, that's some night we're about to have.
Yeah, well, it's implied
it's going to
be about sex. And Before Sunset clearly is about that, too. Following that sex scene and her getting on the train and them having that little, as you said, later, bye, back and forth. Then you have the lyrical Halloween-esque Where They Were montage at the end. Halloween-esque meaning the movie that shows where Michael Myers had been through the night. This one's just showing you in Vienna the great spots where they were, by the river and here and there and everywhere, and including a graveyard, which is a strange touch, but they make that work too.
I like that scene, and that scene's about time. Richard Linklater, obviously, the big, big theme he likes to revisit over and over again. She talks about the 13-year-old who died, and now she's 23, and that little girl is still 13, and I love that notion. And I even love when they go back and you look at all these places again and they look different because it's the locations the following morning.
Mm-hmm.
The light's heading it differently and there's different people and action going on around them.
And not them.
And not them. Again, yes, the passage of time. These places are going to carry on existing without them there, much like they're going to go on with their lives without each other now.
So in a way, it's an alternate universe kind of idea. And thank God in this universe that that bickering couple was there on the train, because in another universe, if they weren't bickering, then maybe Celine and Jesse wouldn't have even met at all.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. We need to, like, get an interpreter to tell us what they were arguing about. I think it was German? They spoke German?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you wonder about fate and that kind of thing. I'm not sure if I really believe in that kind of stuff, but we were introduced because we have the same last name. For those who never heard that story before, we're not in any way related. We're not even going to have kids. Don't worry about any kind of deformities anyway. But we have the same last name before we were ever married. That's why Bev is Bev Ellis Ellis. It's a joke that she's carried on for 2+ years on Facebook. I thought it would last a few weeks. But if we didn't have the same last name, maybe we wouldn't know each other at all.
We would never have been introduced. That's the reason we were introduced. Mm-hmm. That's true.
Or maybe I would have found you some other way. If you want to believe in fate, maybe 6 months to a year later, I would have found you some other way.
Or maybe you would be doing this podcast with some other girl.
Nah.
Yeah, when we had our first date, I'm sure this goes without saying, we had our 3 hours of nonstop conversation.
Mm-hmm, it was.
It was at least 85% about movies, I think.
We also did the smart thing and not talk about past romantic experiences, which they do, obviously, when he talks about Lisa, for one thing. But that's another way to kill romance with each other. Because if you're going to do that, you're talking about failures. They wouldn't be exes if it wasn't a failed relationship.
It's part of the genius, though, of the premise of the film. Because the premise is that they've decided only to spend this one night together. So there's no potential for a relationship to ruin. But also, the circumstances facilitate them to move unnaturally fast and become really intimate really quickly. Also, the reason Linklater decided to set it in a city that was foreign to both of them is because when you're traveling, you're just more likely to be open to new experiences and just open in general. So it's believable that these characters would tell each other these incredibly intimate details about one another very quickly.
Because you have nothing to lose.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if you embarrass yourself or something that you say to them makes them decide that they don't want to be with you, well, that's what was going to happen anyway. And also facilitates that they would have had sex that same night, even though she definitely resists, but she resists for all the reasons. She's worried about her reputation, and she doesn't want to be the slutty French girl.
Although if they had Facebook, he could have both found her quicker, and he could have trashed her if he wanted to a lot quicker.
Yeah, and and actually in Before Midnight, there is a nearly mocking scene where you have a couple that they're having dinner with who's telling the story about how they Skype. They live in different cities, but they have this long-distance relationship just through Skype, and they have cyber sex, there's an old-fashioned term, and it's almost a mockery of the relationship that Celine and Jesse could have had had they been born 15, 20 years later.
Well, our cast is extremely small.
Yeah.
The smallest we've probably ever covered in any of our movies so far. It's just Hawk and Delpy. Well, Adam Goldberg, who's worked in plenty of movies, including Saving Private Ryan, a top 100 project film, he's the kid sleeping on the train, and he's uncredited.
Really?
Yeah, I think I told you it was another actor that often works with Linklater, but it was Adam Goldberg. Hawk's character is named Jesse, but actually his name is James, so I guess he's Jesse James. And then Frank, the phone friend, maybe that's also a play on that. I don't know why it's a Western thing, although one of the many movies that Hawk made with Linklater, The Newton Boys, nothing to do with Jesse and Frank James, I don't think. I haven't seen that movie in so long.
Well, he's very, very American. Even Jesse is such an American name, and he's the typical rude American traveling through Europe, but he's also keenly aware of that stereotype, and he both is that thing and doesn't want to be that thing. He doesn't speak the language, but everything about him is kind of meant to represent a typical American young man.
And the word he picks for the poet by the river to incorporate into some poem, and he's probably right that the guy just incorporates that one word into a poem that he already had. Milkshake. That's going to be a key word in a future Next 100 Project movie. There Will Be Blood.
Oh, yeah.
Which we will cover on February 1st, Bev's final of four choices in the month of Bev. One of Hawk's collaborations with Linklater, we just watched it again for the second time, Boyhood.
Yeah. We've had a big Linklater binge as of late. And that movie really stood up to a second viewing. I was worried that I wasn't going to like it. I was going to find it boring if I knew where it was going. But no, I found it just as engaging as I did the first time.
And it's easily Linklater's most rewarded film by awards bodies. It didn't actually win the major ones at the Oscars people thought it might. It just won for supporting actress for Patricia Arquette. So since this year's Oscars are coming up pretty soon, just briefly, what did you think about the Birdman Boyhood battle for the Best Picture Oscar last year and all the other major awards?
Well, I think I liked Boyhood better, and I think probably Boyhood will be a more beloved film over the years. I think it'll probably stand up better over time. But they were both really gimmicky, and yet they made their gimmicks work. I like Birdman enough that I don't disparage it getting the award. Anybody who cares about the Oscars knows there's a lot of actors, and Birdman is just a movie about actors. It's a movie about artists, so I can understand why the voters are just going to prefer it, because they're going to find that way more relatable than a movie about these nobodies growing up in Texas. People like you and I are going to find that far more relatable, these people growing up in Texas. I think that's part of the reason Birdman would have won. But I can't complain, because Boyhood got all that great attention, and probably a lot more people saw it that wouldn't have necessarily watched it. Mm-hmm. And it was acknowledged that it was much more than the gimmick he used to make the film, because it truly, truly was. The gimmick probably was a pitfall, mostly because how do you cast a six-year-old that's going to be a good actor when he's 18? And that kid
is... Well, he's passable.
But he is passable, but his performance...
He reminds me of Wiley Wiggins in Waking Life, though, the way he talks and the style he has. So either Linklater did coach him that way, or the kid just naturally is that Mondo, almost dull. Well, you could certainly argue that actor is dull, or he's played that way. But I bought it well enough, and I certainly agree too.
Yeah.
So then on to Julie Delpy, who's played Celine four times, including in Waking Life. She was in Avengers Age of Ultron. I don't remember where, but that's one of her credits. Most of her credits you're not going to know unless you're truly an indie buff. So much like her character, she's at her best in this movie, or in this role anyway. And although she's not really conventionally Hollywood pretty, she's certainly very pretty, but she just explodes with light, kind of like Meg Ryan in her best days, I would say anyway. And their writer-director, Richard Linklater, he co-wrote with Kim Krasan. The two stars had input, like I said before. Krasan has only written a few things ever, and she's always been involved in these films. Not much else beyond that. As far as Linklater's direction goes, the very long takes he was already doing in this film, I would say he's a low-key visionary. We mentioned Tarantino. You can't really put Kevin Smith in the category. Scorsese's in that category. Alejandro Gonzalez Iñárritu, who made Birdman, certainly is now in that category, with The Revenant on his resume as well. But in a low-key, small, regular-people kind of way, he's the best at this and always seems to have a great vision. He also works so much. You mentioned he's hit and miss. Well, you make that many movies, you're going to have plenty of hits. Maybe not blockbusters, but movies that are both good and people go to see them.
Yeah, he's not showy, but he really loves to take risks, which means sometimes his films fail, and like a lot of people, I didn't love Waking Life. I didn't even really like.
Oh,
really,
I did.
Like, you did? I didn't really like Slacker even.
I wasn't as big a fan of that one.
Yeah, it's a little bit harder to watch, but when he does hit the bullseye, he makes something so unique and special.
Another one that people don't talk about much that has, I think, only three actors total is Tape. Hawk again. Robert Sean Leonard from Dead Poets Society, along with Ethan Hawke. That was Hawke's breakout, really, working with Robin Williams and those other young actors. And I think it's Uma Thurman who plays the woman, and it's this big build-up to this reveal of what's been going on between the three of them. Quite well played. Probably cost them $15 to make it. It doesn't look very good. I think it may have been a digital video kind of film back when that was just getting going. Mm.
I haven't seen that. Mm. Now I absolutely have to see that.
Probably hard to find, but we'll give it a shot.
Well, the internet has come here to save us and help make things that were once hard to find very easy to find. I won't have to meet it at a train
including
station in
somebody,
Vienna 6 months from now.
You didn't see for 9 years. Linklater's producer, Ann Walker McBay, mostly works with him and not really anybody else. We talked about this a lot on the Top 100 Project films, where directors would have the same crew, producers, actors over and over again. Linklater is not really an exception. Technically, the movie is 185:1. We watched the DVD. It's okay looking. Nothing wrong with it at all.
Yeah.
Decent DVD. Lee Daniels shot it. He also worked on Before Sunset, Boyhood, and other Linklater films. Sandra Adair cut it. She always works with Linklater, and she did the two sequels and Boyhood as well. Cut that film down from however many hours they had of footage to still 2 hours and 45 or something minutes.
Yeah, still a long film, and she worked on that movie for 12 years.
I like to call that one 12 Years of Filming. That came after 12 Years a Slave. It won the Oscar the year before.
But they said that they changed the script as they were watching it get cut together over the years. That he changed the direction of where he wanted these characters to go because he could see how it was working.
Makes sense. This has now become the Boyhood podcast. Fred Frith was the music composer. He's an English composer. Hasn't really done a lot else of note that I can see on his resume. Bringing us to The Influence. Of course, the sequels, Waking Life, which we talked about plenty. And I mentioned that the ending of this must have been the basis for the awful Serendipity. And the awards and list section. We're not going to have a ton of these on these movies we're picking now, probably, because they're not AFI beloved. So no Oscar nominations, although the sequels did get nominations for their screenplays. Before Sunrise was not nominated for either the 1998 or 2007 AFI Top 100 lists.
Come on.
But it was nominated for the Top 100 Passions and probably should have slunk on there somehow.
Yeah.
Slacked its way on there, if you will. Maybe 82 or something, but it did not do that. Okay, we know you love the film. You said that already. You did choose it. I enjoy it, too. What are your last thoughts on Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and even Before Midnight?
If there wasn't Before Sunset and Before Midnight, then you'd be able to say that there's no film quite like it, but then the sequels really match it. It is just as special and unique and wonderful as the type of night that it's conveying. And I sincerely hope that Linklater gets credit for creating one of the greatest, most unique romantic works of art of a whole generation. It conveys romance the way romance really is. And it gives you that feeling that you get when you're falling in love.
And you got it all over again when you saw the movie about, I hope, me.
Sure, definitely. I never met anybody on a train when in my 20s.
Nice cover. Okay. Good film, good series. If you haven't seen these and you're just listening to us because you're loyal to our podcast after being a fan for a few years, then we recommend all three of them. And do watch them in order or else you will be a little bit confused by what's going on.
I don't think that it could be spoiled if you do know details about what happens with Jesse and Celine.
It's about the feeling, not about the
plot. Yeah, that's a really great way to put it. It's about the feeling.
There's not much romance in next week's film because on the next 100 Project in 7 days is a modern crime classic and Quentin Tarantino's impressive debut, Reservoir Dogs. So the coming attractions trivia for Reservoir Dogs. Quentin Tarantino is famous for making pop culture references in all of his movies. Which three of these nine are not name dropped in Dogs? Marlon Brando, Elvis Presley, Lee Marvin, Aretha Franklin, The Lost Boys, Pam Grier, Superman, The Great Escape, and The Fantastic Four. Write those all down quickly and name three that are not in Dogs.
I love how much they run the gamut of the different parts of culture.
They're all possible. That's why I chose the three that don't belong. They still would make some sense in any one of his movies to get name dropped.
All right, so for the answer to that question, please tune in to next week's episode of The Next 100 Project. If you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. You can also find us on Twitter. I am @BevEllisEllis for reasons that were explained earlier. And Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And while you're there, please rate us, review us, and you can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. If you'd like to message us directly and privately, we'd love to hear from you guys. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
All right, let's keep talking, but we'll go get some champagne on layaway, go to a park, lay down on the grass, and we'll see where it goes.
You Canadian boys are cheeky. And cut.